we've seen ongoing Zionist incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. But why are Jewish settlers, who are protected by brutal armed Zionist police and military personnel, so determined to access Al-Aqsa? In today's programme, we'll examine the forces behind the incursions. We'll look in particular at the activities of the Temple Institute and who's ploughing money into its programme of desecration of Al-Aqsa. We'll also look back at International Quds Day, which is traditionally marked on the last Friday of Ramadan. And we'll ask why it was founded and how it's affected the Palestine Solidarity Movement. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra about the extremist Temple Institute.
With the continued Israeli assault on Al-Aqsa, the beatings of worshippers and the shootings of journalists, it is essential we hone in on the movement behind this apocalyptic campaign. The Israeli occupation forces are acting in service of the Temple movement. A push with international and Israeli government backers, which aims to bring down Al-Aqsa once and for all and replace it with temples for Jewish worship. The Temple movement is led by Yehuda Glick, US-born Likud party lawmaker and former part of the Israeli intelligence corps. The official body of the movement has stated, "We must liberate the Temple Mount from the murderous Islam," and even published a blueprint and computer animation of what Al-Aqsa would look like once demolished, and a detailed depiction of the temple to be built on top in its place. The chief rabbi of the Temple movement is Yisrael Ariel, who has called for the destruction of mosques and Christian spires, and that if this is not accepted, you kill all their males by sword, you leave only the women. Ariel was given an award by the mayor of Jerusalem for his work with the Temple movement. This movement has been funded by the Israeli government through millions pumped into it by the Ministry of Education. It was also funded by the former Deputy Defense Minister, Eli Ben-Dahan, while he served in that position. He describes Palestinians as beasts who aren't human. The Israel Ministry of Education, under current Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, included various Temple movement organizations on its list of recommended field trip sites. During his time, the Ministry of Education handsomely funded the Temple movement. Israeli ambassador to the UK, Zepi Hotevli, has supported the organization, speaking at its events, and has stated it is her dream to see the Israeli flag fly over the Temple Mount. Other supporters include genocidal justice minister Eilat Shakid and the architect of the anti-BDS Ministry of Strategic Affairs, Gilad Erdan. Other funders of this movement may come as a surprise. For example, Simon Falik, the man behind the empire of duty-free America shops throughout airports, is a major backer of the Temple Mount movement, in addition to illegal settlements in the West Bank. Another funder of the Temple Mount movement is US billionaire Henry Swaker, who also funded the David Horowitz Center, which employed British Islamophobe Tommy Robinson and US dilettante Ben Shapiro. These are the forces pushing Al-Aqsa closer and closer to destruction. We must resist.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Dan Cohen. Dan's a journalist and award-winning filmmaker, and he's the Washington DC correspondent for Behind the Headlines. His journalism cuts through the propagandizing narratives that are such a feature of the corporate media. And he delivers hard-hitting investigations without ideological reservations. Dan spent several months in the besieged Gaza Strip filming the documentary Killing Gaza. And he joins us from Washington, D.C., and we recorded his contribution earlier. We started by asking Dan about whether the destruction of Al-Aqsa is really a stated objective of the Temple movement.
The Temple movement is absolutely dedicated to the destruction of the Al-Aqsa compound, including the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Qibla Mosque. It's made that clear in its literature, its statements from top leaders, and it wants that to happen by the actions of the state, not by vigilantes who seek to smuggle in some kind of explosives to destroy the holy site. So we see many Israeli government officials and Hasbara peddlers denying this reality. But if you actually go and listen to what these temple movement figures and settler fanatics have to say, and not only settlers, actually, you know, relatively mainstream figures in Israeli government, in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, they're very explicit that this thing has to be, that these Islamic holy sites have to be destroyed and removed from the face of the earth.
David, why do you think the Israeli military and police are not actually stopping these incursions? It seems extraordinary that they're just sort of standing by and we're seen to be facilitating it.
Well, they're not, as you say, they're not standing by. They are facilitating it. They are keeping people, Muslim worshippers, locked inside the mosque on occasion. They are dispersing people who've come to pray with violence, pushing old and young alike, using rubber bullets. All sorts of violence is being enacted upon Muslims during Ramadan. And they do that on a regular basis to escort parties of settlers, Jewish settlers, who come and do a tour around Al-Aqsa, which is pretty extraordinary, including some who are not even settlers from Palestine, but who are tourists who want to become settlers, and they're getting a shot at a sitting foot in Al-Aqsa, which is, you know, which is supposed to be against Jewish law, but they are being, so they are being facilitated. Now, this is a process, and they're trying to build the process such that they can start to allow the Jewish settlers who come for the tours to start to do things like pray or conduct religious services. And indeed, in many of the cases we've seen, the attempts in the last few years, the attempt by some of the people from Temple Institute to bring young kid goats into Al-Aqsa to sacrifice them for Passover. So, and that's being stopped. The police are not allowing that to happen. And people have seen the footage of this, of, you know, settlers with a small goat in a plastic bag trying to get into Al-Aqsa. That's been stopped. But they are facilitating by violence the access to Al-Aqsa.
Absolutely incredible. Well, we also asked Dan to tell us about the history and trajectory of the relationship of the chief rabbi, Yisrael Ariel, with the Israeli government.
Yisrael Ariel's trajectory has been basically he was radicalized. He was part of Gush Emunim, the settler movement, and was radicalized by the withdrawal from the Sinai, the Camp David peace accords, in which Israel withdrew from Sinai Desert in exchange for normalization with Egypt. And Yisrael Ariel, in addition to the most extreme factions of the settler movement, were radicalized by this and wanted to find a way to stop the withdrawal, this territorial withdrawal. They are fundamentally opposed to the state of Israel ceding any inch of territory to any other country. And so to stop this withdrawal, they basically decided we have to take over the Al-Aqsa compound. Yisrael Ariel was the chief rabbi of a settlement in the Egyptian Sinai called Yamit, and he blessed a suicide plot of young settlers to barricade themselves inside a bunker and threaten to commit suicide in order to prevent the evacuation of Israeli settlements from the Egyptian Sinai. The only way that was actually stopped is the Israeli government flew in Meir Kahana, the top fanatical rabbi, the top extremist rabbi in the country, who's actually from Brooklyn, and basically negotiated with these young settlers to come out of the bunker. But Yisrael Ariel was the only rabbi who would agree to their suicide plot for these young men to kill themselves inside this bunker.
And we asked Dan if it was true that Ariel was involved in a plot to demolish Al-Aqsa.
Yisrael Ariel was found to be leading a plot of young men to dig a tunnel into the Al-Aqsa compound so they could take it over. They thought they would tunnel in the night, go up on top of the compound and they believed they would take it over and destroy the Dome of the Rock and the mosque. That was found out. And Yisrael Ariel decided then that instead of radical vigilante action, the way to accomplish his apocalyptic goals was through the education ministry, that he would have basically an ideological revolution in Israeli society. And so that's when he founded the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute began to receive money from the education ministry as early as in the 1980s, with the explicit goal of destruction of the Al-Aqsa compound, building of a temple, and conversion of Israel, which is an ethnocratic state, into a full-on genocidal theocracy.
I mean, David, the Al-Aqsa is one of the holiest sites in the Islamic faith, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine a site of similar significance to any other faith actually being desecrated in this way and then being virtually ignored by the international community?
Well, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, that this could happen to a Buddhist or Hindu or Christian institutions, certainly not to Jewish institutions. And it's a mark of the way in which Islamophobia is encoded into the hard DNA of the Zionist movement, and that they want to assault the Islamic faith, not just Al-Aqsa, but the Islamic faith in general and its followers. But it's not only Muslims that they are opposed to. We can see also in Jerusalem what's been happening in relation to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, one of the most holy shrines of the Christian religion, where mourners have equally been attacked by Israeli forces who've been tear gassed and have been refused access to the church over Easter. And so that we should recall it's not just Islam that they have a problem with. It's also other religions that are not Judaism. But Islam is the first amongst equals of the bad religions in their book.
Yes, indeed. Well, we then asked Dan about how the temple movement interacted with the settler movement since the 1980s.
Since the 1980s, when the temple movement began this idea of taking over Israeli society, this was at the same time that the settler movement in general began its takeovers of Israeli society. So as the temple movement becomes more prominent and this desire to destroy Al-Aqsa and build a temple becomes more prominent in the Israeli settler movement, the Israeli settler movement was taking over Israeli society in a very carefully crafted plan and strategy that saw them take the levers of power. So that's essentially what the temple movement's impact on Israeli society is today.
I mean, David, you know, the Israeli regime claims that it doesn't support the destruction of Al-Aqsa, yet it's funding an organization that does. I mean, can Muslim governments around the world trust the Israeli regime's stated position on this, do you think?
Well, of course not. The short answer to that is no, they can't. But what's really significant here is the way in which the Israeli regime has been increasingly subverting its professed positions in, for example, directly supporting the Temple Institute. And it shows the way in which the credibility of the Zionist regime in relation to settlements, in relation to Al-Aqsa, in relation to all the matters of concern to the Palestinians, is a position which is there for public consumption, to try and pretend that they are interested in some way in a Palestinian state. I mean, clearly nonsense, and they show that by their actions in practice.
Well, we then asked Dan to tell us about other Israeli politicians who've been outspoken in their support for this movement.
There are dozens and dozens of political figures, including elected officials inside Israel, who have been explicit about their support for Zionist designs on the Al-Aqsa compound, not only limited to the far right, the apocalyptic Zionists, right, we could call them, but also among the Likud, which has basically become a temple party as a result of a carefully crafted strategy by a member of parliament named Moshe Feiglin, who is essentially a disciple of Meir Kahana. You also see this increasingly in the last several years in the liberal parties in Israel expressing support for Israeli sovereignty over the Al-Aqsa compound, saying that, you know, we must control it. We should have, you know, Israel should have full security control. And also they use the trope of prayer rites at the Al-Aqsa compound.
And finally, we asked Dan to tell us about the prohibition on Orthodox Jews praying in Al-Aqsa and how that's been abolished.
It is completely forbidden in Orthodox Judaism to step foot onto the Temple Mount. It's a sin considered so grave that it is punishable by a divinely imposed death sentence. It is one of the most grave sins in Judaism there is, because basically this site is considered so holy that to show deference to it is to stay away from it. However, Zionism sees this site as a place of conquest, as a place to be conquered, as a site to be conquered. And so as Zionism has shifted to the right, more and more regular, everyday Zionists see this not in religious terms, but in nationalist terms, that this Al-Aqsa compound, what they call the Temple Mount, is a place that, because they believe they're in a Jewish state, that Jews should have rights to.
David, you know, many people were surprised when Tommy Robinson attended a demonstration with Zippy Hotavelli, who's a supporter of the Temple movement, as you know. But as we've revealed, I mean, Robinson's employer was also funded by Henry Sweker, who backs the Temple movement. I mean, what other overlaps exist between the settler movement and Islamophobia around the world?
Well, there is a very striking overlap between those organizations in the US and indeed in the UK who are funding settlements, funding the IDF and similar activities, and those organizations who they're also funding, which are Islamophobic. So the Islamophobic network of the key organizations in the US and the UK, the Henry Jackson Society in the UK perhaps, or the Middle East Forum, or the David Horowitz Center in the US, they are also funded by the same organizations which fund the settlements. So it's a very, very close and tight-knit overlap between those two sets of organizations, and that's because they share the same objective: settlement in Palestine and anti-Muslim prejudice elsewhere.
Mm. And I just wondered if you could say what your thoughts are about how the Zionist occupation forces are treating Palestinian Christians in Jerusalem.
Well, we've seen this over Easter this year, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is one of the key holy sites in Christianity. And Palestinian Christians attempting to go to pray there have been attacked by the police and by the military. They've had tear gas and rubber bullets shot at them. And so we see what's going on here. It's not to do with the hostility to Christianity or Islam in general, although there is that. It's also to do with the fact that these people are Palestinians. They don't want the Palestinians to have any rights whatsoever. And of course, this is in the context of occupation, where the Israelis are the occupying power, and where these effectively are war crimes, and they are committing these day and daily with a really very little response in the international media.
Mm. Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment and have a look at this report on the creation of International Quds Day and its impact on the resistance movement to Zionism today.
In the week of commemoration of International Quds Day, we see continued incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque by occupation forces and settler colonialists. As the attacks intensify, Quds Day reminds us of the history of the efforts to unite the resistance in Palestine and beyond to the Zionist entity. The decision to mark Quds Day, adopted by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini not long after the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, was aimed at highlighting the approach of the Revolutionary Republic towards the Palestinian struggle. That approach was to challenge the ruling hegemony of the US and the Western countries and to call for unification of the Muslim world against their influence. At the time, Khomeini saw Iran had developed an unprecedented dependence on the US and the West, and its close ties with Israel under the Shah were a crucial element of that relationship. picking that relationship apart and fostering what's become today's axis of resistance has been a significant achievement of this process. For example, Hamas stated in 2019 that International Quds Day has restored the credibility of the occupied Quds as the first Qibla, or direction of the Muslims. A Hamas representative also stated, "The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized the importance of the role of the young people in supporting the issue of Palestine and opposing the occupation." Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's Secretary General, opened the Solidarity Convention for the support of the Intifada in Beirut on May 22, 2001, with the words, "We share the same destiny with the Palestinian Intifada till the liberation of Jerusalem." The first Quds conference was held in Beirut to support the Palestinian Intifada. It led to the establishment of the Quds Foundation, with headquarters in Beirut, the capital of liberation and victory. The foundation was subsequently listed as a terrorist entity by the U.S. Department of the Treasury, an indication of the importance of Quds Day in the minds of the enemies of Palestine. Fittingly, it's Zionist groups who present as defenders of the Jews, but in reality act directly for the Zionist entity, who are at the forefront of today's attack on Quds Day, such as the Community Security Trust and the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism in the UK, or the Anti-Defamation League in the United States. The attacks show that the Zionists fear a united resistance.
David, what does the campaign against Quds Day in the West consist of, and who's it led by?
Well, the campaign consists of attempts to denounce Quds Day demonstrations in the UK or Canada or France or Germany or the US as being somehow anti-Semitic. And these are led by organisations which have a formal mission to defend Jews from anti-Semitism and racism, but whose actual mission is to blur the lines between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, to pretend that anti-Zionism, which of course is what Quds Day expresses, is the same as or very similar to anti-Semitism. So then these are groups which of course have direct relationships to the Israelis. The ADL in the US, the Anti-Defamation League, has been working very closely with the FBI and indeed with the Mossad since the 1940s, since even before the formal creation of the Mossad, and the CST in this country, Community Security Trust, also has trained with and been trained by the Mossad. So it's very clear that there's a close relationship there with the State of Israel.
Do you think there's a wider international context to the development of a collaborative resistance which Quds Day's helped to develop?
I think when you see the phrase, the axis of resistance, it refers to an axis in the Levant and in the Middle East. But what we see today in the reshaping of the world and the geopolitics, the Russian intervention in the Ukraine, and what that means in terms of the relationships between countries in the axis of resistance, for example, and China and Russia and India and even other countries like Brazil, we see an emerging multipolarity. And Quds Day, in a way, has helped to bring that closer together, because it's shown how collaboration can work and how collaboration makes the enemy fear what your togetherness.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, because unfortunately we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, children of temporary visa holders who can't gain permanent residency in the U.S. are one of several groups urging the Biden administration to act on an immigration overhaul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Aishwarya Kavi. The piece is titled, They Grew Up Legally in the U.S., but can't stay after they turn 21. In 2011, after 5 years of working and living with his family in the United States on a temporary visa, Bharathi Mohan Ganesan submitted green card applications for his wife, his 5-year-old daughter, and his 11-year-old son. Mr. Ganesan, who was born in India and has also lived in Singapore and Australia, was nervous about when his wife and children might gain permanent residency of the United States. He knew the waiting list was specially long for Indians on his kind of visa, an H-1B, which allows American companies to employ skilled foreign workers. Because of chronic backlogs, it can take years to process those on work visas who apply for permanent residency. Last year, a decade after he applied, Mr. Ganesan, his wife and his daughter received their green cards. But his son had turned 21 and missed the cutoff by a matter of a few months, leaving him scrambling for a visa that would allow him to stay in the United States. Mr. Ganesan's son is among more than 200,000 children who grew up in the United States under the protection of their parents' temporary visas, which can be renewed indefinitely. But the children risk losing their legal status when they turn 21. Unable to become permanent residents of the United States because of the backlogs, or because they were never eligible in the first place, they must obtain a different visa, remain in the United States without legal status, or leave the country entirely. According to the Cato Institute, more than 10,000 children aged out of green card eligibility each year. Untold numbers eventually depart the United States, often leaving their families behind. These young people do not qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA program, created by executive action during the Obama administration. The DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, protects from deportation about 650,000 youths, or DREAMers, who were brought into the United States and have remained without legal status. Because the program requires applicants to be undocumented, it does not offer those with legal status a way to stay in the United States. A comprehensive immigration overhaul is highly unlikely to pass a deadlocked Congress in a midterm election year. The Biden administration has been under increasing pressure as a Trump-era public health order, known as Title 42, is said to be lifted in late May. A move that is expected to create a surge of migration across the southwestern border of the United States. A bipartisan group of senators restarted immigration discussions on Thursday, 28th of April, to try to identify standalone proposals that would have the support of both political parties. When asked on Thursday, 28th of April, whether the Biden administration, which is updating the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the DACA program, was considering extending protections to documented youth, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, told the House Judiciary Committee that the department did not plan to do so. Its focus was to fortify the existing DACA program and shift responsibility for documented youths to Congress, he said, adding that their situation spoke to the imperative to pass immigration reform. In interviews, more than a dozen people who lived in the United States on temporary visas from a young age described their struggles with anxiety and the financial burden of navigating how to remain in the country they considered home. They are urging the Biden administration, if it will not provide a path to citizenship, to offer a way for them to legally remain in the country. Mr. Ganesan's son, Niranjan Bharathimohan, is able to stay in the United States until this November only because immigration officials extended his dependent visa. Mr. Bharathimohan, a student at the University of Texas at Dallas, will have to go to Singapore, where he was born, to apply for a student visa that will allow him to return to the United States and finish his degree. His application might be rejected since he previously tried for a green card. He has shown an intent to immigrate to the United States, which is not allowed. Applicants may be asked to show that they intend to leave the country after completing their courses. Mr. Bharathimohan faces the prospect of being stuck in Singapore, where he has no family and no roots. How is he going to manage alone? Mr. Ganesan said. I was really devastated that just because of my country of birth, my son's opportunities are very limited in the United States. While there are protections to keep families together when parents move to the United States on temporary work visas, those end when children turn 21, because they are no longer considered part of the family unit. I don't think people who originally wrote the laws foresaw a situation where children brought here on visas would be raised and educated here, but not have a clear opportunity to stay and become American citizens, said Dip Patel, the founder of Improve the Dream, an organization that campaigns for a path to citizenship for those children. Dip Patel added, delay in taking action will not only lead to tearing more families apart, but also continue the immense emotional turmoil faced by thousands of families. At a Senate hearing in March, Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, the top Republican on the panel's Immigration Subcommittee, vowed to work on legislation to help people who had grown up in the United States without a clear path to U.S. citizenship. Muzaffar Chishti, the director of the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law, described the issue as one of many in a system that has not been truly updated since the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which established the pathways for legal immigration to the United States that are still in place. Short of a legislative overhaul of the system, Improve the Dream, the advocacy group, has worked to increase awareness of the issue and is urging the Biden administration to make changes. But children of non-immigrant visa holders have criticized the Biden administration for being too slow or unwilling to take action on proposed changes, such as the expansion of the DACA program to include documented youth. Among the proposals is one that would modify how U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services determines whether an applicant qualifies for a green card, allowing more children and minors to remain eligible as they near the age of 21. Another would classify applicants as children beyond their 21st birthday to keep them in line for a green card, which is the policy for those who are refugees or asylum seekers, or are sponsored by relatives who are U.S. citizens. Matthew Burke, a spokesman for the Immigration Agency, said the Department of Homeland Security was keenly aware of the challenges for documented youth in the United States and was exploring legal methods to provide immigration relief to this population where possible.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting, and my two guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaikum assalam, glad to be here.
You're welcome. Well, it's a couple of episodes. To be more specific, two episodes ago, we talked about and criticized the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard, and with some major actors and actresses, in fact, in the movie, like Tom Hanks and Felicity Jones and Irfan Khan. But we haven't finished criticizing this movie, and hopefully we do it today in this episode. Before asking more questions from our dear guest speakers, let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie, and then we'll be back and ask the questions. Don't go away.
The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who refuse to act in time of crisis. Dante's hell isn't fiction anymore, it's prophecy. We have created our own hell on earth.
Oh, my.
The warnings have been obvious, the solutions ignored, so I took action. If you're watching this, it means the Inferno virus was released last night at midnight and is now being carried to every corner of the Earth.
Oh, my.
Within 6 days of its release, the virus will replicate itself in every man, woman, and child on Earth. Expect the current... the current population to be culled by half. The survivors will witness horrors unknown to this planet. But I want them to know why, that this was our doing, and this is our salvation.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critic program on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting, and my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, in that part, the antagonist character, the bad person in the movie, says, "The darkest place in hell is reserved for those who refuse to act in time of crisis. Dante's hell isn't fiction anymore. It's a prophecy." So there is so much emphasis on these so-called Western intellectuals and their legacy, not to mention, well, like Dante and the like. In the sequels, we also see Galileo and some other people just coming up and popping up in the movies. The bad person, the antagonist character in the movie, in that part, continues to say, "We have created our own hell." The question is, have we created our own hell on Earth?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In a certain way, yes. I feel like we could have taken better care of this, you know, this very big blessing that God has given to us, which is this Earth. And, you know, we have made a lot, you know, we've destroyed it. Sometimes, you know, some researchers say far beyond repair, but some say that we can still repair it. The question is, you know, we didn't really have control. You know, the people who knew this, who knew that they had a responsibility towards this Earth, you know, weren't in control most of the time. And you see these like big corporations or these, you know, more powerful entities take control of, you know, the bigger part of Earth, whether it's in resources like as in oil or, you know, any other natural resources that we have. Or, you know, like over vast regions, and they control them. So at the end of the day, we have to do what we can to preserve it. But the question is, you know, have we destroyed our own selves? Mm-hmm. I don't think so, not to the extent that he's describing.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break again by listening to another part of the movie, and I'll be back with this question. Don't go away.
During the Black Death, the Phoenicians made all the ships anchor in the harbor for 40 days before they would allow their crews into the city, making sure that they were not carrying the plague. The word quarantine comes from the Italian, quaranta, 40.
It's nice to have you back, Professor.
There. The horses.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mama Jawad. Hosting this program, we are criticizing the movie Inferno with Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Sayyid Abdullah, in order to ask you, or before me asking you this question, which is a kind of complicated question, I need to give you a little bit of background, and the dear audience may refer to some scientific works, and more specifically in linguistics. Because of my own background in linguistics, we have several terminologies and theories regarding that. And some of the scientists and linguists in our own field of study, they distinguish between linguistic imperialism and language imperialism. By linguistic imperialism, we all know what linguistic is, which is an adjective for linguistics, and imperialism also. But linguistic imperialism, this combination, in fact, is a little bit vague. I need to expose it a bit and explain it. Linguistic imperialism means the imposition of one's own language over another's. All right? We understand this. When some invaders, in fact, occupy a place, they try to change their culture, language, and so on and so forth. So you may expect linguistic imperialism to happen there, right, in the occupied land. But what about language imperialism, not linguistic? Language imperialism means a kind of translation of foreign key terminologies into familiar vocabulary of one's own linguistic tradition. Why? In order to claim their concepts, their theories, their conceptions, to diminish their culture's originality. This is what the imperialists usually do, all right, to their colonies. Or to pretend to have full comprehension of a foreign topic or notion by simply switching it into their own lingua. Mm-hmm. We see this happening several times in lots of Western movies, especially Hollywood movies. And more specifically, when they were talking about the term quarantine. Well, in that part, the professor claims that the term quarantine originates from Italian, quaranta, meaning 40, and quarantine, 40 days, during the Black Death in the 14th century, because of bubonic plague. Of course, he's right to a limited extent. If you refer to Webster's dictionary, that is given there too, all right? So this plague, which, you know, the whole thing, I'm talking about these kinds of appropriation of such terminologies and notions and claiming them to be theirs. Well, lots of linguists argue against it. They say that, no, it came from the Muslim scientists and doctors and physicians that they use this term to isolate. We also have quarantine, right, in Arabic, to isolate their patients in different wards of their hospitals back then in those days. Is it really a pathetic act of appropriation?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is a pathetic act. I mean, throughout this movie itself, we know it's not only this term that was hijacked by the movie industry, but even there was a scene when they were kissing and thing, they were talking to each other. He quoted Dante, and she said to him something along the lines like, how do you use Dante on me? And it's not love, it's beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So even he was trying to change a verb, hijack it, and into something that he feels that would make sense, or at least it would play on the mind of the listener, which is her, his girlfriend. So he changed love or beauty into love. She corrected him.
Mm-hmm.
So in these things, if it suits them, they correct it. But if it's, you know, historically speaking, like I said, if you quote the dictionary, it just makes a lot of sense. You know, they do go back to that far. But if you go to the origin of it, you find that it's not Italian. So we have a lot of, you know, even scientifically, they said the majority of the stars that are known to us today are named by Arabic names. They're not English names, they're not Latin names. A lot of people don't know that. The numeric numbers are Arabic.
Exactly.
There are so many numbers and so many words. The origin is Arabic. For example, zero is Arabic. Yes. Assassin is Arabic. So many words in English that people think they are English origin, or at least they are, what do you call it?
Or they came from other languages.
Yeah, from other ancient cultures, languages. Which is not the, you know, it's not Roman, it's not Italian, it's actually Arabic. Mm. So they do that. They do that a lot in movies, which actually,
distort the reality.
They do. That's the idea of it. They give you that, so they completely throw you out of balance when it comes to you thinking it could be from a different country.
Not even all people are scientists. They cannot refer to books and scientific circles to find out the truth.
Exactly. So even with medical surgery, a lot of the tools that are used now in hospitals are actually Arabic named.
Yes.
Yeah, so, but people don't know. So they try to their best to make sure that you don't go back to the origin and find out that the Arabs or the Muslims were the founders and the pioneers of these things.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another short break and we'll be back.
During the plague of Justinian, 5,000 people died every day in the streets of Istanbul, the border between East and West, another doorway, which is why he chose it.
If the bag's intact, we can contain it, but if someone ruptures it before we get there...
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting, and we are still criticizing the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard in this program. Well, Brother Hussein, in the part we just listened to. In fact, we need to be a little bit fair, because last time when I was asking Syed Abdullah this question, that sometimes some colonizers or colonists hijack the culture, language, and everything of their colonies. And later they claim that all of their even scientific advancements are theirs.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like they ignore the legacy.
The origin.
Yeah, the legacy of other cultures. And then the only culture that exists on the earth is theirs. No other cultures, in fact, have improved. Well, but at least to be fair to this movie, we don't see like the other Hollywood movies that try to portray the East as somewhere quite backwarded, you know? So we have to give them
some credit.
Yeah, some credit, you know? They don't attach or relate Muslims or the East only to something is gonna, you know, bad is doomed to happen, for example. They bring everything, like the West and the East. The scientists are working from here and there.
They show both
the good
sides.
People are here, the good as well as the bad people. They are everywhere, basically. All right? Yeah. What do you think of this?
Well, of course, at the end of the day, you're always hearing the winner's side of the story, mm-hmm. because they have the power to tell you it.
Yes.
The losers are always silent because, of course, nobody listens to them because, they're the losers. In this situation, the West is the one who's in control, the one who, won this battle of, in terms of technological advancements, in terms of, economically, financially, whatever you want to call it. At the end of the day, the West is more powerful now than the East, and that's why they portray the East as this like backwards place or whatever, because they seem that they have more control over them when mm-hmm. they actually took most of their advancements and the base of what they have right now from the East, from mm-hmm. Eastern philosophers and scientists.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Hussein and Syed Abdullah, for your contribution to the program Viewpoint, the Mood Critique program on IRIB English Radio. We hope that you pray for us and keep us in your du'as during these last days of Ramadan. And we try to criticize the movie Inferno. And we hope that you like this program Viewpoint. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dante's Inferno.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago. Why Dante? Why this map of hell?
Someone created a plague.
Without Professor Langdon, no one could find the virus.
Oh, my God.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.